Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle, hosted by Dr. Thomas Führinger-Kuhnt.
Product is your mechanism for creating change in the world. That is such a profound concept. You're voting with your labor for the world that you want to create through the products you build. When I talk to teams and I ask them to share information with me in these three questions, how well did it work? What have you learned? What will you try next? I get two things. One is I get reality from the ground. They're not going to bullshit me with numbers that I want to hear. I really want to hear the good and the bad. Don't just spit out numbers and regurgitate dashboards at me. Now I know, actually, what have they figured out? What we are stuck on is evaluating and measuring people. In the corporate world, that's what we keep trying to do. Just evaluation, quantifying performance. And so when you get real answers to these three questions, now I can give people honest feedback and I can develop them in their journey so that they can solve puzzles better.
We thank our sponsor, Codeword Customer Consulting GmbH, your coaching partner in the ever-evolving landscape of UX leadership. Are you a UX professional seeking to level up your career? Then let's get in touch for one-on-one mentoring or individual CV and portfolio reviews. Find our contact details in the show notes. We'd love to hear from you today.
Hello and welcome to Lead UX, the UX Leadership Circle, your compass through the ever-evolving landscape of UX leadership and UX maturity. The show for managers and directors leading teams of experienced UX designers, researchers, and concept developers. I'm your host, Dr. Thomas Führinger-Kuhnt. Our mission here is to explore the strategies and mindsets required to lead transformation and create meaningful impact. Today, we are diving into a topic that touches every leader, product manager, and also individual contributor, performance, goals, and metrics. I'm thrilled to welcome my guest, Radhika Dutt. Radhika is a seasoned product leader, entrepreneur, and advisor to organizations ranging from startups to Singapore's central bank. Many of you might know her from her first book, Radical Product Thinking, The New Mindset for Innovating Smarter, a methodology now published in over 40 countries. She has a profound talent for seeing through management dogma to what actually drives genuine innovation. So Radhika, welcome to Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle. It's really great to have you here on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here, Thomas.
Great, thank you. So usually at first I ask my guests about to talk a little bit about their background and their professional working history. So maybe you can talk a little bit about the way which brought you to where you are currently.
So my background is that I started off as an electrical engineer, but you know, I studied electrical engineering at MIT, but then afterwards I moved into the startup world, and you know, I worked in various sizes of companies in different industries. And I remember, you know, having done electrical engineering, my first job in that startup was doing sales because nobody else wanted to do sales. I was like, fine, I'll do it. And so, you know, it was in a variety of roles throughout my 25-year career. It's been at a variety of companies, different sizes, all the way from multinationals to startups. And it's been a variety of industries, from broadcast, media and entertainment, telecom, robotics, even wine. But I guess there's one common thread. And the common thread is this. While all of that sounds glamorous, it was a bunch of mistakes that I had made in my career, which I now call product diseases. And these diseases are so easy to catch. And that's what I talk about in Radical Product Thinking. So for our listeners, you know, it'll resonate hopefully for you when I say, you know, common diseases that we caught were things like pivotitis, obsessive sales disorder, or strategic swelling. And we can delve into some of these. But my first book, Radical Product Thinking, is about how we can build world-changing products while avoiding these product diseases. And now I'm working on a book about why goals and targets backfire, and what actually works instead.
That's great. So, but maybe some listeners who are not that familiar with the radical product thinking approach, maybe we can dive into this challenges to performance culture and ground our conversation in the concepts that established your reputation, actually, which is the radical product thinking. So as I said, this methodology has been adopted globally already, and it's a core. Its core is a shift, as you mentioned, from feature-centric to more something like vision-centric product development. So you mentioned already some mistakes or experience, let's say, you made throughout your career. So what are the most common mistakes you see product leaders make? Which also is addressed directly by the radical product thinking approach.
So the biggest thing that drove me to write radical product thinking was what I was observing that, you know, there's the Silicon Valley mantra or this mindset that the way you build products is just by iterating quickly. Let's just, you know, quickly build things, throw things in the market, see what sticks. And we'll keep iterating. And the idea is that, you know, if you just iterate enough, and often, you know, in Silicon Valley, you'll also hear, oh, you just keep iterating until you find product market fit. We think that if we just keep iterating, we'll be able to build great products. And my own finding was that that is fundamentally not true. And it's not true for two reasons. First, you have only 2 to 3 pivots before you run out of money and momentum, regardless of how much funding you have or how big the size of your company is. The reality is in 2 to 3 pivots, you know, either you run out of money or your team starts to feel like you have no idea what you're doing. I'm losing faith in this, right? So we have to use every pivot like a magic or like a silver bullet. You have to use it very carefully. So that is one mistake, that just iterating alone doesn't get you to a great product. The second issue with just iterating and this approach is iterating can help you find a local maximum. So meaning you put a solution in the market and you might be able to optimize some things around it by continuing to test it and improve it. But what you really miss out on is the global maximum. So just iteration alone doesn't get you there. What we need is not just the speed and iterating quickly. What we need is speed plus direction. This clarity of what is the problem we're solving? Why does it need to be solved? Because maybe it doesn't. And it's only when we have this clarity of direction that we have speed plus direction, that's when we have forward velocity. Having that direction is what helps us find the global maximum and not just get stuck in the local optimum.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back to, let's say, the first argument you mentioned. So having the silver bullet at hand that you use. But I wonder, how do you get to this silver bullet? How do you actually find it before you put it out there?
Let's talk about this pivotitis disease, right? Which is where we keep pivoting from one thing to the next. What happens? I'm not saying that we should never pivot. You might genuinely find that you need to pivot, but we have to pivot with gravitas. So what does that mean? In the radical product thinking book, I talk about a radical vision statement, which is instead of having, you know, bullshit vision statement, like being the leader in, you know, let's say data storage, or, you know, my own vision statement for that first startup that we had was revolutionizing wireless. You know, honestly, it was a bullshit vision, because what does revolutionizing wireless mean? What's the problem we were setting out to solve? You know, we really didn't know. So when you have these broad vision statements, they don't act like a filter. So the answer to everything is, yeah, let's just do it. And what you need instead, and this is what I talk about in the Radical Product Thinking book, is a fill-in-the-blank statement that helps you define what is the problem? Who has this problem? How are they solving it today? And then we have to answer the question, why is the status quo unacceptable? Because maybe if it's not unacceptable, maybe things are just fine the way they are. Don't disrupt just for the sake of disruption. And then we can define what is the end state and how do you want to bring this about? And I'm happy to share an example of this fill in the blank statement filled out. But to finish that point about how do you avoid this pivotitis, when you start with a clear vision statement like this, when we test things in the market, you know, we might then discover, you know what, we were wrong. We were wrong about who has this problem, or we were wrong about what the problem was. We misunderstood. And now you're pivoting with gravitas, because instead of just doing this whiplash for the team that, oh, today we're trying this, tomorrow we're trying that instead. Instead of that, you're able to point to a vision to your team and you can say, you know, here's where we were wrong. We thought our user or the person who had this problem was this, but it turns out it's actually this person and here's their problem. And by pivoting in this way, where you're sharing with your team where you were wrong, what you're going to try instead, now you're pivoting with gravitas. Now it's not pivotitis, but it's silver bullet every single time, very thoughtfully.
So does this then also need some extensive research where you put all those topics or ground those topics upon?
I love this question. Yes, it is indeed the case, right? Like you might have a vision statement and what you will discover is that in filling the blanks in this vision statement, you'll have a hard time writing this if you don't fully understand this market. You might have assumptions. And the more you understand the market because you've done that research, it becomes easier to fill this in. And so that's a great way of even diagnosing how well do you understand this market? Because as you start to write it, maybe you might discover, you know, we need to do a little bit of research to be able to write this vision effectively.
So basically it means do your homework before you start iterating, more or less.
Absolutely. Do your homework, but this gives you structure for how do you do that homework? Because for a lot of companies, right, doing user research just feels like, oh, you know, that is scary. What is the starting point of user research and where is the end state? Because you can keep researching all you want and that feels scary to leaders. And now this starts to offer some scaffolding. It's very clear in terms of what I want to find out. And they can see the progress as you do this research. You know, I've figured out the answers to this vision statement, right? Like, here's what we discover is the problem. Or you can frame it in a different way, you know, because maybe sometimes the fear is, I don't want the user research team to write the vision statement. You know, it might be that you start with a radical strategy, the RDCL strategy. The RDCL stands for R for real pain points. Who are the personas who have this pain and what exactly is their pain? What makes them come to your product? The D is the design. What is the solution for this pain, right? I'm not talking about just the look and feel. I'm talking about the actual, what is the functionality that solves this pain? What is the underlying capacity or capability that we need, right? That's the C, the capability. This might be tech. It might be partnerships. And then the last question is the logistics. What's the business model, the pricing model, the marketing message, the communication, etc. As I mentioned these four, right, you can already see how all of user research starts to fit in. To be able to develop a solid product strategy that I have confidence in, you know, to know the persona, to be able to understand their pain point, to be able to figure out what is the right solution, etc., all of that is grounded in user research. And that is something that you can use as scaffolding to say, here's what we're answering. And you can show progress to teams so research doesn't seem so scary.
You mentioned a couple of minutes ago a practical example that you could share. So that's also something I know what the listeners are interested in. So can you give a practical example of where you use actually this approach for better silver bullet findings?
Yeah. So let's talk about an example of a vision statement. So here's the vision statement for a wine startup that I'd founded in 2011, sold in 2014. So here's the fill in the blank statement. Today, when amateur wine drinkers want to find wines that they are likely to like and learn about wine along the way, they have to find attractive looking wine labels or find wines that are on sale. This is unacceptable because it leads to so many disappointments, And it's hard to learn about wine in this way. We envision a world where finding wines you like is as easy as finding movies you like on Netflix. And we're bringing about this world through a recommendations algorithm that matches wines to your taste and an operational setup that delivers these wines to your door. So now, this is a radical vision statement because I didn't tell you anything about this startup, but hopefully you knew exactly what we were doing and why we were doing it. And now hopefully you can also see how all of user research fits into even helping me answer this vision statement. So I'll give you one example. You know, I said today when amateur wine drinkers. What did I mean by amateur wine drinkers? You know, to me, on a wine scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is a novice and 10 is a winemaker level knowledge, we were targeting people level 2 to 6. Why? Initially, our market, we thought we could target all wine drinkers. But when we did some research, we figured out people from a level 6 and above, they were too snobbish. They felt like, you know what? What can you teach me about wine and through your algorithm that I don't know? And so we targeted people from a 2 to a 6 because those were the people who wanted our help, right? And so these are ways that you can use research and craft a vision statement, and you'll see that this helps you pivot much more thoughtfully.
Yeah, that's absolutely interesting. Now let's take it to a bit of a more organizational or strategic level, because this podcast listeners are also interested how they can bring those concepts into their organizations. So what you also introduce and I think already described as a target is product depth. So leaders understand technical depth, but you expand the idea to include strategic, organizational, and also cultural depth as an accumulated cost of misalignments, right? So for our audience, can you explain the concept of strategic depth? I think it gets already a bit clearer from your example, but how it is also incorporated in your radical product thinking approach?
Yeah. So in the book, I call it vision debt. And let's talk more about, you know, what it actually means. Because the first thing I'll say is, you know, no matter how great a vision you have, the reality is that you're constantly, as a leader, having to balance this vision, which is long-term, against the short-term business needs you have. You know, you might have this long-term idea in terms of UX that you want to revamp UX, but the short-term might be, you know what, that's not what's going to bring in revenues. I have revenues that I have to hit at the end of this year. So you have this long-term versus short-term that you're constantly balancing. And so for the entire organization, it's really helpful to make it explicit. How are we balancing long-term against short-term? And it's helpful to make this explicit because, you know, as a leader, you want to scale your influence. You want people to think like you do, and so that you don't have to be in every meeting. So that even when you're not in that meeting, people, you know, they will make decisions like you would have. They would have made the right trade-off of long-term versus short-term. So how do you make that explicit for your team? And the way you do that is through an X and a Y axis. So now we've talked about what is a good vision, how to write a good vision, right? So your vision, which is the long term, is your Y axis. And the short term is your survival, and that's the X axis. And so the quadrants that emerge, they are what is good for both vision and survival. That's easy decisions. And if we're always doing, you know, what is an easy decision, then we're sometimes being myopic. So sometimes we have to invest in the vision. So that is when you're doing something that's good for the vision, but it's not helpful in the short term. So an example of this might be either fixing technical debt, or it might be, you know, maybe you want to do some research and spend some time on revamping your UX. That's investing in the vision. And the opposite of that is vision debt. This is what you were talking about, which is where you're doing things for the short term. So let's say, you know, bringing in revenues. So you're bringing in revenues, and that's great for the short term, but it's not great for the, and you're doing it in a way, let's say, that's not great for the long-term vision. So an example of this might be maybe you're releasing a feature where you introduce new pop-ups. You know, maybe it got the engagement you needed in the short term, but by God, that just, you know, makes the user experience that much worse. That's vision debt, but it was a quick way of releasing a feature. So the question is, you know, when you're balancing long-term versus short-term, how are you balancing these quadrants? And there's no right answer. The right way of thinking about it is, how often are you taking on vision debt? Are you investing in the vision? Because when you have a product, you know, you're catching obsessive sales disorder if you keep taking on vision debt, where you keep doing things that are good for revenue, but maybe not for long-term vision. Examples of this would be taking on custom features, you know, just tacking on easy UX models and features, et cetera. But, you know, long-term, it's not a coherent way of thinking about your product, et cetera, et cetera. We all know these examples. And so how are you balancing vision versus survival?
Okay, that's interesting. I know such metrics, for example, from stakeholder management approaches where you, you know, decide which stakeholders you would manage closely and others, they are ready to work on their own, so to speak. And you also said you would avoid to be in every meeting and make people thinking like you would do. So I wonder if being in the center or in the meetings and where decisions are made differ between those quadrants. So I assume in the bottom left corner, people would be able to decide on their own because it's not strategically that important and it's short term. Whereas in the upper right corner, if I didn't mix anything up, you would be rather in the decision-making process as a strategic UX leader, right? Because it's more long-term and it's more strategically important.
Oh, I think you're thinking about the 2x2, which is what is important and what is urgent, right? And that is a way of thinking about what you delegate or not, right? But this way of thinking is more about how are people across your team balancing vision versus survival. So the danger quadrant is the quadrant which is both bad for long-term vision and bad for survival, right? So an example of danger quadrant, I can give you one is, you know, I remember at a company, the salesperson was really eager and said, if you build this custom feature, you know, we'll be able to win this mega deal. So we thought we were saying yes to vision debt. So we took on that feature. It was supposed to be vision debt. But what happened? That customer never signed on at the end. So we built this custom feature. We turned it on. And now we hadn't won that deal either. And it took a long time to build. And so we basically had built something in the danger quadrant. It wasn't great for survival and it wasn't good for the vision. So the way of thinking about these quadrants isn't necessarily about delegation. It's more about aligning everyone on what is the right balance between long-term versus short-term. And the reason I talk about it in this way is, you know, let's say, for example, that you're a bootstrapped startup, that you have no money and, you know, every month when you win a deal, even if you have to take on custom features, you're doing it to survive. So the way to deal with this is, I sometimes, you know, when I've been in that situation, I've told my team, look, this is vision debt. We're doing it because we have to survive. At least my team knows that we're doing this to survive. It's not that I don't believe in the vision. I acknowledge that this is vision debt. So in terms of what is the message I'm giving to my team, I'm telling them that we're doing this for short-term survival. So, you know, if they're building something, they know that they're doing this. They know when to take on technical debt, that it's about speed right now. And they know that there's going to come a time we are going to have to pay this back. And I will need to be thoughtful about that. We will have to pay back the technical debt we're taking on. So this is a way of creating that alignment, you know, on, well, yes, we're taking on vision debt now, but we will pay this back. We are going to do something in investing in the vision as soon as we stabilize a little bit.
So one thing I wonder, I mean, your concept or your approach is known by many people right now, but also if I explain concepts like this in the organizations, especially to people with an engineering background who maybe are not familiar with UX design that much. It's sometimes hard to get, you know, their buy-in for such concepts. So how do you actually explain this or get buy-in from people to follow this approach actually?
Yeah, such a great question. And there are multiple levels of this, right? Usually I find that even engineering is an easier stakeholder to bring on board, because when you talk about vision versus survival and you can really explain this, they'll instantly identify with the vision debt quadrant because they've had to deal with so much technical debt. And so when you talk about it from this perspective of, you know, just like you take on technical debt and you hate it and you know how you have to pay it back, this is, you know, a vision debt that we might be taking on by creating a pop-up, but you're telling me this is the easiest way of building it. That is one way, you know, even in terms of alignment, to create alignment with engineering, just because this concept of technical debt and investing in the vision will resonate for them. The harder stakeholder sometimes I find is actually with leadership in the organization. That, you know, sometimes leadership might tell you, oh, we need to build this feature. Our competitors have this feature, go build this feature. And then, you know, you're stuck there thinking, wait, but I don't even think this is the right feature for our customers. This is not what user research is telling me that we need, right? And that's a tough situation to be in. So one of the things that I found is in that situation, you can't even go at it by telling leaders, well, what is our vision? Here's a radical vision statement. Challenging in that way, when you're not part of the leadership team and saying, we don't have a clear vision, blah, blah, that's like a bull in the china shop. So the way I've approached it sometimes is much more gently. You know, on the vision, so I draw up on the whiteboard a vision versus survival chart. And I draw up these X and Y axes and I show these four quadrants. And then I talk about what the leader is asking for. And I share, you know, here's why I believe that this is vision debt. And what we're hearing, here are some anecdotes from customers, why I think this is vision debt. And now, you know, I'm not directly challenging the vision, but it sort of begs this next question, which is, well, so how do you define as this x-axis? What is the x-axis? And I talk about what survival is. This financial survival is maybe what I'm thinking about. And then I talk about what the y-axis is. This is my my moment to pull out the vision that I've written out. And I might ask for feedback. You know, this is how I wrote the vision. You might have a different opinion. But now the key is, it's not my opinion versus yours. I'm now aligning us on vision versus survival. Let's align on where we might be different on the vision versus survival. Mm-hmm. It's not a subjective decision anymore. It's not personal. We're talking about this 2x2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what if your stakeholders decide for, let's go for survival?
You know, that I think is a fascinating question, and it happens so often, right? And I think, first of all, you try to point out how often you're taking on vision debt. You ask these questions like, you know, when would we invest in the vision? You try to point out some of the consequences. There's one example, you know, that I once pointed out to of Snapchat, how they built a bunch of vision debt features. From a UX perspective, you know, it was a bunch of features that optimized for revenues and user engagement, but it was features that people hated, and it actually eroded usage of the platform, right? And so we can see how vision debt would do that. So first of all, you know, we can try to push back and show how often are we taking on vision debt, etc. But then, you know, I'm going to talk about this longer term question where I think as an individual, at some point you have to question, what is your own vision, right? You have to think about, what is your vision for the change you want to create in the world? And that is a big question, because the way I talk about product, you know, product is the change. Product is your mechanism for creating change in the world. Your mechanism for creating change in the world. That is such a profound concept, right? Because you're voting with your labor for the world that you want to create through the products you build. And so eventually, there's a question you have to answer. What is the world that you are voting for with your labor? Are you in faith? Like, what are you voting for? Is that what you want to continue to vote for? And if you take on this vision debt over and over and you cannot get your company to agree with your values, it's a question for you to say, is that what you want to keep doing? Is that where you want to cast your vote, or do you want to find a different place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this reminds me a bit of a Jared Spool quote. He says something like, "If as UX designers, if we do a great job today, how can we improve our users' life?" So that's should always be our end goal, to think about, yeah, how we can improve everyday's life of our target users, so to speak.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even that question of improving users' life, right? There's often this obsession with, oh, I want to delight users. And I think we can be more thoughtful about what does that mean? And I'll give you an example with AI right now. I was just reading this article today on New York Times, and it talks about how OpenAI, it has been optimizing their ChatGPT for user engagement metrics. You know, how often will you, how can we increase user engagement? One of their goals for user engagement metrics is increase user engagement by 5% by the end of this year. So how has that played out? You know that ChatGPT's model that they released in April 2025 was much more sycophantic. And the problem with that is that, you know, it has tried to delight users by telling them exactly what they want to hear, giving them a ton of validation. But it has actually caused emotional distress for people, that it's led to 9 hospitalizations that the New York Times was tracking, 2 deaths. This is just what the New York Times has tracked, right? And that to me is profoundly scary, that we hold so much power in terms of the products that we create in the world. We have to be thoughtful about what does it mean in terms of creating a great user experience. It doesn't necessarily mean agreeing with users. And I'll give you a counterexample to this. The Central Bank of Singapore, they apply product thinking to how they build products, how they think about policy even. And the head of the central bank, you know, he has often said, we're not trying to create a great experience by just saying yes. We are still going to be thoughtful, deliberate. We're going to be strict in how we enforce regulations. But the way we create a good experience is when we tell you no, we will give you certainty and speed in saying no, right? We're not going to keep you hanging for long. We have to be thoughtful about what is a good user experience.
Yeah, and yeah, that's true. Users sometimes don't know what actually good user experience would be for them. This old quote from Henry Ford, who said, if I would have asked people what they need, they would have said faster horses. And of course, that wouldn't have been the perfect solution for them. And that's why he came up with something else. And yeah, I am in the automotive industry, so it's for more than 100 years been a quite successful product in the end, which actually solves users' problems, which is getting from A to B. Yeah, so that's definitely the case.
A fascinating example. Like, that quote is so often misused, right? It's often misused to say, here's why I don't need to do user research. Because, you know, I know that I just need to show users something amazing. You can't possibly, you know, do user research and tell me this is not what they need. I just need to show them, and then I know that this is what they're going to need. Like, very often the quote is misused to make that case. And to which, you know, I feel like the whole point of figuring out, you know, what a user needs is not by asking them, do you need a horse or do you need a car? It's really about seeing their needs, when the iPhone came out, it's not because they just came up with this out of the blue. They deeply understood the problem statement that it was hard to interact with these devices using just text. It was deeply painful to use internet on a RIM, on a BlackBerry. And that is why they came up with an iPhone. It was understanding the pain point deeply, having done user research. It wasn't just, I'll just come up with this and show you something and you'll start adopting it.
Yeah, yeah. If you use that approach, I mean, it's often used in automotive industry as well. Engineers always have great ideas, but then you most probably haven't done any user research at all, probably, yes. So, yeah, now let's switch gears a little bit and come to your current endeavor or your new project, kind of. So this discussion leads you leads us perfectly into this area, I think. Because in your current, let's say project, you're challenging the way modern business works, or especially in tech, is managed with OKRs and KPIs and stuff like that. And, you argue that these well-intentioned systems often create the opposite of what they actually promise. So short termism, performance theater, and burnout. So maybe you can explain a little bit your thinking behind this, yeah, challenges to more or less well-established concepts.
Yeah. So let's talk about, you heard me start to talk about this even with OpenAI and how mm-hmm. optimizing for user engagement, et cetera, is creating sycophantic AI and how that is detrimental for society, right? But let's take this on a regular scale, like what happens in companies. It's not just that there are consequences for society when we're just optimizing for metrics, that it creates, you know, short-termism, but harm for society. But even for companies, this isn't, it isn't a good thing to have goals and targets. Here's why. When you set a goal or a target, the incentive that you create for people is to show that they're a high performer and that they've hit those targets. And so even just subconsciously, the behavior that it drives is that I'm going to look for the positive numbers that affirm that, look, this initiative is working, that I'm going to show you the numbers that you wanted to see. And subconsciously, what is happening is that you're ignoring the bad numbers. And the bad numbers are often what actually show you that there's a problem or that there's an opportunity, that there's something here that you could be addressing. And so one thing that is really important for us to think about is, if goals and targets backfire, well, why are we still continuing to pursue them in the corporate world? And it's because we have not challenged this mindset in over 75 years, that all the way from Peter Drucker's work in the 1940s, we've been thinking that goals and targets are how we build businesses. I'm happy to go anywhere you'd like with this. There's a lot that I just mentioned here.
Yeah. I mean, it just, what pops up in my mind is back then when those metrics were used, we had a completely different industry, right? So we could measure performance in output metrics in the industry, which was producing things and the revenue wasn't made with like ideas and innovations and stuff like that. So it was a completely different industry. And back then it makes sense. And the question now is, how can we use or change those metrics? Actually, if we have a team, I mean, we wanna make people grow in our organizations. We wanna have a fit between personality, personal goals, and the tasks at hand. So somehow we need to judge whom to promote to which position and stuff like that. So, what's your perspective on measuring? Maybe the wrong word here in this context, but measuring the individual performance and team contribution without the yardstick of such KPIs?
Oh, so there are so many things to unpack in what you said. So let's get to measuring people in just a moment. But let's talk about, you know, what you said in terms of how, where goal setting works. Because what you were pointing out is exactly right, that goal setting works in a setting where there's one right answer and it's easy to measure that output. So, you know, in fact, in the 1940s, the workforce was very different. Peter Drucker, when he came up with goal setting, he was actually working with the automotive industry. You mentioned automotive earlier. And, you know, he was working with General Motors, and that was a perfect place to use goals and targets, because there's one right way to install tires, and it was very easy to tell who's a high performer and not. And in the current workforce, you're exactly right that, you know, what produces results is more like solving puzzles. It's solving hard problems where there isn't one right solution. And this is where goals and targets, even research shows, goals and targets do not work well in settings where there isn't one obvious right answer. And so what works instead? What I found is that this approach to puzzle setting and puzzle solving actually works a whole lot better than goals and targets, because that is naturally more suited for the kind of work that we're doing. So puzzle setting basically means you're defining what is the problem statement and what might we explore. And the puzzle solving, the acronym I use for that is OHLA, O-H-L-A, which stands for observe, hypothesize, learn, adapt. For all of our listeners in the UX space, hopefully this will resonate, because what I started with was observe, right? If you think about how we work today, if you think about lean startup and what they advocate for, it's been about build, test, learn, scale. The focus has been on jumping into the solution space, jump to solutions, iterate. Whereas this approach is different. When you set a puzzle, you first need to look at the puzzle. Think about a Rubik's Cube. You need to look at the puzzle and understand what it looks like before you can attempt your first attempt. And so this is why the framework is observe, then hypothesize, then learn, and then adapt. And so that is puzzle setting and puzzle solving. Now to answer your next question about how do we measure people. So one thing that I'll talk about is in puzzle solving, every time you attempt a solution, we answer three questions. So the three questions are, the first one is, how well did it work? Notice that I'm inviting both the good and the bad. I'm not just saying, did you or didn't you achieve this? How well did it work? The second question is, what did you learn? So this is where I say, don't just give me lots of numbers and dashboards and metrics. Tell me the story. What is really going on? What have you figured out from the data? And what is it telling you? And then the third question, based on how well it worked and what you learned, if I gave you a magic wand, what will you try next? What will you try next, right? And so now going to evaluating people. These three questions are really profound, because when I talk to teams, and I ask them to share this information with me in these three questions, how well did it work? What have you learned? What will you try next? I get two things. One is I get reality from the ground. They're not going to bullshit me with numbers that I want to hear. I really want to hear the good and the bad. Don't just spit out numbers and regurgitate dashboards at me. I want to understand, what have you figured out? Now I know actually what have they figured out, right? And then the third question, like, what will you try next? Then I know, what is the next experiment you want to try? And I can course correct. So going to your question of how do you evaluate people? Well, what we are stuck on is evaluating and measuring people. In the corporate world, that's what we keep trying to do. Just evaluation, quantifying performance. What you really want is to develop performance. And so when you get real answers to these three questions, now I can give people honest feedback and I can develop them in their journey so that they can solve puzzles better.
I think what is crucial to grow as an individual contributor with this approach is you need some space to actually think about those topics, and thinking takes time. And what I experience, and also with AI, it doesn't get better. So the speed in daily business is increasing. So how do you actually ensure that people can even think about those topics before and provide you with the answers you want them to think about?
Yeah, such an important question, right? There's a beautiful quote I came across recently, and the quote is, "We don't learn from experience, we learn from reflecting on experience." We learn from reflecting on experience. Like, that is just so profound, right? And we never take time to actually reflect. And so one thing that I've been doing with companies is, when we use this puzzle setting and puzzle solving way, we've instituted learning meetings. So we set up learning meetings where product managers will share information about, you know, maybe features that they released, or even when we run a design sprint, you know, in our learning meetings, we will share information on, for each puzzle, how well did it work, whatever attempt we were trying, what did we learn, what will we try next? So these learning meetings create space for reflection. One thing we can think about as leaders is just, how do we create the space for reflection for our team, so that we create this time for everyone to be able to do collaborative learning? That's how we can actually take the time to see what happened, what we learned from it, and what we can do better to adapt, right? Without that, we never will. And along those lines, one thing I'll say that shocked me is, there was an interview of Sam Altman from OpenAI on New York Times a couple of years ago. So it was a year after ChatGPT came out. And he was asked, well, it's been a year since ChatGPT came out, what are your reflections? And you know what he said? He said, oh, it's been so busy, I haven't had time to reflect. And that is downright scary to me, because if you don't reflect, how can you create the change you want to in the world, right? You're just going to keep throwing things out there and then claiming, oh, whoops, that was unintended consequences.
Yeah, that's absolutely scary. You're right. Especially it comes from a, let's say, top management person. Yeah, because they should actually use the time for reflection. Definitely. So you said you organized those learning meetings with your teams. So have you had any experiences with cross-organizational meetings, maybe with other teams, or maybe even outside your organizations? Do you think this would be beneficial as well to also learn from people, maybe even from other industries and stuff like that?
Yeah. Maybe there are two things I can cover in this, which is, one is within the organization, like how do you spread this, and then cross-organization, right? So within the organization, how do you spread this idea, create learning meetings, get everyone to adopt this mindset? So the way we approached it is, you know, I'll share what didn't work well. When I started out, realizing the importance of puzzle setting and puzzle solving in terms of goal setting, my first attempt was, I tried telling leaders, look, goal setting backfires, don't use goal setting. And that didn't work well. Why? Because there was a fear that goals is how I know to do things. It's the devil I know. So even if you tell me it doesn't work well, it's way too scary to move away from that. And so the solution was to make leaders aware of the downsides. But the way we introduced change was, I worked with a product team so that I introduced this approach of puzzle setting and puzzle solving to the product team. And, you know, we did these learning meetings. People started using this approach to show, you know, just how well features were working. And once I felt comfortable that they were really getting the hang of being able to present information in this format of how well did it work, what have I learned, what will I try next, right? Then we started using this in monthly business reviews, and we started using this across the organization. And what was really wonderful is, you know, at the beginning, when I started working with this company, the head of sales, she had said that when we were running user research meetings, She had said, oh, you guys are wasting customers' time. You're asking very basic questions that you should know the answers to. Why are you asking them about their workflows when you should know this, right? But as she saw the results from all of our learnings, when she saw, you know, how well it's working, what have we learned, what will we try next, and she saw the progress in the product, you know, now she says that puzzle setting and puzzle solving, it really has helped us listen to customers and do better. We doubled sales in 2024, doubled it in 2025, and that was after sales had stalled in 2023. So tremendous results, right? And so my point is, you can introduce this to your organization very systematically and step by step. And I'll pause there, and you can tell me if you still want me to answer this question about other industries.
Yeah, I would be interested in that before coming back to the let's say, this grassroots approach, how you introduce it in your own company. So do you think it also would work with cross-organization and even in other, with people from different industries?
Yes, and I think this whole puzzle-based mindset, like if we think about, you know, just everything that we approach as humans, when we learn, right, we're constantly solving puzzles. So one of my things is that I love learning languages. I speak many languages. And I've realized that learning languages, it's like puzzles, right? You're constantly solving this puzzle. You're cracking this puzzle of understanding and decoding this language. And so if you think about how we learn best, we learn not because someone set us a goal or a target. We don't learn because someone artificially said you should embrace failure, fail fast, learn fast. Again, those are a bunch of bullshit mantras that are artificial and overlaid onto constructs that don't work for learning. Whereas puzzle setting and puzzle solving is the natural way of learning. So going back to different industries, right, and different places where you can approach this, sales, to be able to grow sales, that you can look at as a puzzle. So instead of setting a target and saying, hit sales of X million by the end of the year, you can set it as a puzzle, which is, you know, I see that sales grew in the last 3 years, but it has stalled in the last year. What's happening? Is it that maybe something has fundamentally shifted in the market? Is it that maybe our messaging isn't working for the mass market, but it worked for the early adopter? This is a puzzle we can crack. And now taking it to different industries, not just, you know, solving the puzzle of how to get product adoption, you can look at it in different industries. I was just talking to someone who is a lawyer. And, you know, he heard about me talking about puzzle setting and puzzle solving. And he was like, you know, when you're looking at a legal dispute, it essentially is like solving a puzzle. You start with a problem statement or a complaint, and then you do discovery. And the point of the discovery is to really figure out the crux of this problem, uncover it, and you want to figure out what is the fastest off-ramp so that you can not even have a legal case. That's the first thing you want to look out for and try to solve as a puzzle. And then, you know, you might try other strategies. Like this whole mindset of puzzle setting and puzzle solving as opposed to goal setting is the most natural way of working. And now finally, we have a scaffolding or a framework to help us use this in a way that's not just driven by intuition, but something that we can do very deliberately.
Yeah, I see the point. So coming back to your example of language learning, I mean, when the best way to learn a language is to step out of your comfort zone also a little bit and expose yourself with people who actually speak the language already and just try it. And so it's really kind of as I said before, a kind of a grassroots approach. Try something. And also what I'm up to with this idea of cross-organizational exchange, you know, I'm visiting meetups quite often here in Frankfurt area, and it's always so enlightening to hear people talking about the problems they face, because overall, there are many similarities. And then if people explain something they have experience and which worked well, like the examples you gave before, this really, this creates light bulbs over my head. And then you think, okay, if it works for them, maybe I can try it out by myself as well, even if it's if somebody's working in a completely different kind of organization or industry.
Yeah, I love it. And I feel like, you know, especially when we're thinking about UX, what we're really constantly solving is that puzzle of, you know, what is it that this user, you know, why aren't they using maybe this product? Maybe that's the artificial, the superficial complaint. But the open questions, we approach it with curiosity, like a puzzle. We say, you know, I wonder what's happening. Like, why doesn't this resonate? But like more like, how do they work? How is it different from how some of our other users are working, right? And we ask those questions out of curiosity. And that is what puzzle setting brings to the table. It brings approaching it with curiosity. And going back to the language part, right? We learn languages because we approach it with curiosity, like genuinely figuring out, like when someone is saying something, oh, what might that mean? Being curious and even making a mistake and saying, oh, what can I learn from having made that mistake? And learning from it. But we don't have all these artificial constructs, and we don't, in learning a language, we don't say, oh, we have to embrace failure. You just sort of spit out some, you know, half-made sentence, you know, and I've been working on learning German. Yes. Der, die, das, and all of these things, I absolutely make a ton of mistakes, and I'm sure I don't get them right most of the time. But you know, you sort of just have to throw it out there, and you know, you learn just by speaking.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So, wrapping up all this, what would be your advice for our listeners when they come into the office next Monday? What could they actually do? Do you have kind of a toolkit, or what would be your first step for somebody maybe working in an OKR obsessed company even to introduce or to start changing a bit of the mindset in their company?
So one thing we can do as leaders is you could use this approach to be able to look at an initiative that you've taken on. Think about framing it as a puzzle, the problem statement, some open questions that you could approach with curiosity to uncover that, right? And then what is the summary of that puzzle? And then thinking about that initiative and saying, what did you try and how did it go? You know, how well did it work? What have we learned? What will we try next? And then you can share this with the team. And by doing that, what you're role modeling for them is being able to share this with sort of openness, talking about the good and the bad in terms of how well it went, what the learnings were, what you would try next. So you're role modeling this. So that's the first thing. And so for all of our listeners, you can download the OLA toolkit, and I can share a link for that. It's a free toolkit while I'm working on the book. You know, you can use this. And you're also welcome to reach out to me on LinkedIn and tell me about your experiences. And, you know, if you want to share your experience, it might also just make it into the book as a case study. So feel free to share how it went. And I'll share a link to my LinkedIn profile as well so people can reach out to me.
Yeah, that's really a great offer. So yeah, we will definitely also share this in the show notes. Then people can have a look at that and contribute to your, tools, and maybe even make it into the book with their showcase. That would be really awesome. So yeah, is there something, kind of final words you would give to our listeners, maybe also people who think about their next career step, if they should step into a leadership role or not? So yeah, what would be your final advice for aspiring UX leaders out there?
Maybe I'll share a personal story. And the story is about, you know, the first time that I ever opened a Coke can. So I was 12 years old. In India, until that point, you know, you always had glass bottles for Coca-Cola or whatever it was, but you always had glass bottles and a bottle opener. So the first time I opened a Coke can was at an airport when I was moving from India to South Africa. And, you know, since I'd never seen a can before, I shook it nicely to just hear what's inside, just to make sure. And then I opened it. As you can imagine, it didn't go well. And luckily, none of the Coca-Cola got on me, but it was all over. This poor guy who was sleeping on the seats right next to me. And he woke up and, you know, he was all frazzled. And I was so embarrassed as a 12-year-old, you know, how could I not know this and so on, right? But I couldn't have known this. It was my first time. What was really amazing was this guy. I still remember, you know, he could have gotten really upset, but, you know, I was profusely apologetic. And he had such a nice attitude. He was like, it's okay, it's okay, don't worry about it. And he was so kind and thoughtful. He made that experience better. Now, obviously, I learned from that experience. And what leaders can take away from this and what stayed with me from this experience is we are in a position of privilege every time we are witnessing someone learning from mistakes. We can either make that a really difficult experience, or in how we are being present, we're able to make that an experience that someone can genuinely learn from and grow. And people can learn better when, you know, we don't make it a terrible experience that they never want to reflect back on, right? And so one thing to take away as a leader is you can be thoughtful about how are you going to show up as a witness for someone else's learnings. And that that skill that we want to develop as a leader is to be able to guide someone in their development, right? But without creating this feeling of shame from their learnings. So how might you do that? And I think that for me has been the greatest lesson as a leader. What is that right balance in how you show up so that you can guide someone in their learning and be the right witness?
Great. Yeah, great advice. And thanks for sharing this very personal experience from your childhood even. Yeah, absolutely fascinating. And I think you're offering a really compelling alternative with your approach, which will definitely resonate with the leaders listening and the teams looking for more meaning and less burnout in their work as well. So thanks a lot for being my guest today on Lead UX, the UX Leadership Circle. And it was really a pleasure talking to you and listening to your great examples.
Thank you so much for having me on. I so enjoyed our conversation.
Great. Thank you a lot. And thanks to our listeners who joined today. We will provide all the links in the show notes, of course. And as Radhika mentioned, she's happy to, if you reach out to her, and also I am, if you reach out to me. And I hope you're leaving with a renewed sense of clarity and purpose about how you can structure your team's work for maximum impact. So see you next time and keep designing great experiences. Thank you. Bye-bye.